Phoenix Force climbed aboard the nearest Mi-26 Halo, stashed their AKS rifles, extra mags, and dropped their bags containing their biohazard suits on the floor in front of their seats. The helicopter could carry up to 85 soldiers. In this case, the number was closer to 40. The rest of the interior space was taken up with stacked, cargo-netted, and strapped-down crates of ammo and other supplies. Manning sat in a narrow jump seat from the wall next to McCarter. As he belted himself in, he leaned close.
Our Spetsnaz handler almost seems normal. What do you think?
They only foam at the mouth after they're green-lighted.
Takeoff, conversation was impossible because of the noise. Like the Spetsnaz troops around them, Phoenix Force pulled on the well-worn ear protectors chained to I-beam struts above the fold-down seats. McCarter clicked on his flashlight and began studying the sheaf of maps Captain Illich gave him. The topographical map showed the steep terrain. The maps of the monastery revealed a complex floor plan that changed countless times over the centuries as the building's ownership and function shifted. Large dining rooms were walled in, turned into rows of small cubicles, then re-expanded as the walls were knocked out, only to be walled in again. The catacombs beneath the structure were mapped in even sketchier detail. Only the main trunk corridors and branches were well-defined. They descended to a depth of a quarter mile under the mountain, where they appeared to end. As McCarter stared down at the cave map, he wasn't the least bit reassured. Search and destroy missions below ground were never easy, not even with good intel. Confined dark spaces were made to order for ambushes, booby traps, and anti-personnel mines. And this wasn't good intel. He knew bullshit when he saw it. On top of that, Phoenix Force was going up against Russia's best, not regular army. Commandos seasoned in Chechnya and Afghanistan, the anti-terrorist and anti-insurgent campaigns of the past 20 years, soldiers trained and expert in unconventional tactics and weapons, willing to die for the cause. Cigarette smoke hung over Sid Slaney's sunken, timber-beamed living room on Bainbridge Island, Washington. The acrid, cottony layers partially obscured the mid-morning view of Eagle Harbor and the Bainbridge ferry dock out the plate glass rear wall. Three unwelcome guests lounged on the conversation pit's sofas. For the 20th time, they replayed the recorded destruction at the Discovery Bay restaurant on his plasma TV. The explosion rocked the local news camera like an earthquake. Talking head reporters, uniformed EMTs, bystanders, and local police ran for cover, but the person behind the camera valiantly kept filming. With screams ringing in the background and the echo of the explosion ringing off the hillsides, the lens panned upward, catching the jettisoning debris and ascending column of dirty white smoke. The restaurant itself was hidden around a turn and behind a stand of stunted trees. As the airborne junk rained to earth, the camera swung back to the highway just in time to catch a brassy blonde woman with a badge and gun clipped to her belt climb out of the back of an ambulance and charge for the county sheriff's roadblock. She was yelling and holding a gory wad of gauze against her cheek. The guest with the video controller freeze-framed her anguished face.
Bloody dyke.
Sid Slaney looked on, speechless. After 18 years under the deepest of deep cover, the sleeper awoke to an unthinkable nightmare. Spetsnaz Lieutenant Boris Luria, the comedian and social commentator holding the video control, was a dark-complexioned Tartar, hairy and heavy-set, with short, powerful legs. Ovid Belenko, the man sprawled next to him on the couch, had thin knife-fight scars on his shaved head and across both sets of knuckles. Filled-in bullet scars, like nickel-sized and shaped blobs of pink wax, deformed Belenko's right forearm from wrist to elbow. The third member of the Special Forces unit wore his brown hair in a crude burr cut. Oleg Raskov's upturned eyes and mouth made him resemble a perpetually gleeful feral fox. The three of them chain-smoked Marlboros and drank room-temperature vodka from tall water glasses. Slaney's massive Woodboro coffee table was littered with empty red-and-white-striped Tom's brand potato chip bags and crumbs and cardboard packaging from three party-sized heat-and-eat pepperoni pizzas. These strangers weren't just eating his junk food, smoking his cigarettes, and drinking his booze. They raided his wardrobe as well, in search of clothes that would allow them to merge into the alien landscape. They ransacked his closets, appropriating his Pacific Northwest brand name outerwear. With the exception of Luria, they were more or less his size. Because of the Tartar's short legs, he had to roll up cuffs of the borrowed ex officio climbing pants. Sid Slaney waited so long for activation that he stopped believing it would ever come. Even so, his old spy school training stuck. He always followed procedure, notifying his faceless masters in Moscow on a prearranged schedule that he was in position and operational. He wasn't a sexy James Bond 007 spy, more like a James Bland 00-nothing. He used the opportunity his covert insertion provided to earn advanced degrees in computer science and business administration at the University of Washington and Seattle U. He became a highly paid project manager in a wholly owned subsidiary of the local software megalith. Slaney the Russian spy sucked up the American sweet life like a bottomless ice cream soda. In almost two decades of undercover, he passed on no secrets to his handlers. He discovered no secrets. In fact, he hadn't even looked for secrets. His mission, until today, was to remain hidden and in place, to stay off the FBI radar and wait. A little after 7 o'clock a.m., when he received the activation call on his cell phone, complete with secure password verification, the submarine grounding was already all over the television news, as was the White House cover story about the vessel's scheduled official visit and tragic accident. The caller told him to expect relatives that morning, and his orders were to facilitate their holiday. There was no elaboration, no question and answer session. The call ended abruptly, but not before the authenticating sign-off cues were exchanged. Slaney immediately called his secretary at the Redmond corporate campus and took a rare sick day. He guessed the operation was a covert rescue. Russian military intelligence was trying to sneak certain select survivors of the naval accident out of the country before they were discovered and uncovered. Most likely, they too were spies. Their escape route of choice would probably be through Canada because it was so close, but Mexico was also a possibility. He thought he was going to be their travel agent. The moment Slaney's visitors pulled the white Volvo station wagon inside his garage and he saw the automatic weapons in their laps, he knew he was in big trouble. Spies didn't carry cigarette butts. Cigarette butt was the nickname for the 74 Stubby. Inside the house, things went even further downhill. And, in a way Slaney never anticipated. His visitors proudly opened waterproof, airtight, foam-lined Pelican cases and showed him the sealed glass vials of the biological weapon. Three separate cases for the seeding of Seattle and Point South. The Tartar then boasted an attack on the United States was underway, conducted by elite elements of special operations. He said the submarine grounding was just the beginning of the assault, that as a result of the master battle plan, the Cold War was not only going to be revived, but it was also going to turn suddenly and irreversibly hot. At that moment, Slaney realized the full extent of his own jeopardy. No way would such an operation be sanctioned by Moscow, and his call to participate in it was a trick and a betrayal. In the old days, in the old USSR, he dealt with Spetsnaz agents. The times were much different now. The personnel was different, too. Without a flutter of empathy or regret, this Special Forces troika watched television coverage of the bioweapon spread through Port Angeles, with hundreds of innocent people keeling over and dying horribly. They reserved their tearful, overblown sentimentality for toasts to the bravery of fallen comrades in the submarine and of others, fathers, brothers, and friends lost in Afghanistan, Chechnya, and elsewhere. Heavy drinking prior to battle wasn't characteristic of a crack Russian military unit, but the action they intended wasn't combat. It was terrorism, complete with suicide. When they released the weapon in a population center, they too would be exposed to the deadly bacteria. Rather than suffer and die from the effects of red frost, Luria told him they planned to kill themselves after the deployment. They were boozing to numb their fear and bolster their courage. Unlike the 9/11 hijackers, their mission had nothing to do with misinterpretations of God's will and the desire for instantaneous transport to heaven. From their conversation, Luria and the others didn't believe in heaven. They didn't believe in political struggle. They didn't believe in communism. They didn't believe in the old Soviet Union, either. They subscribed to much more ancient codes, what Slaney considered to be lizard brain codes. Blood for blood, fire for fire, pain for pain. Revenge and devastation in the name of what they perceived as lost honor. They were soldiers of Genghis Khan.
Oh my God.
The Spetsnaz made no attempt to hide their contempt for him. In their view, he was corrupted by his prolonged stay in the States, by the rich and easy lifestyle. It was the opposite of their experience over the past two decades. While he wallowed in stock options and waterfront real estate, the true heroes of Mother Russia suffered hardships, ignominy, and despair. The suicide team showed him the biological weapons to make him afraid and compliant. Apparently, everything so far had gone like clockwork. The Spetsnaz invaders kept well ahead of the pursuit, and despite all the hubbub, were still an unknown commodity. At least one of their goals was within easy reach. Downtown Seattle was a half-hour ferry ride away. All they had to do was lay low at his house for 5 hours, then take the 3:50 p.m. boat to be in position for rush hour. The airtight plastic cases containing Megadeth sat on Slaney's gleaming oak floor. There was no reason to think they would fail, and Slaney couldn't let them succeed. For one thing, his ex-wife, Janie, lived in Fremont, a Seattle suburb just north of Lake Union. She was a corporate lawyer for the same software giant he worked for. That's how they met. They separated 3 years ago, but were still close friends. Janie never knew his real past or his secret life. Chances were good she was going to be among the dead this day. 20 years ago, when Slaney signed on with the intelligence service, it was to defend his country against enemies, foreign and domestic. Slaughter on the scale of Hiroshima and Nagasaki wasn't part of the bargain. Based on crimes already committed in Port Angeles and Discovery Bay, these conspirators were the biggest mass murderers in U.S. history. Slaney knew they were going to murder him, too, either to cover their trail, or maybe just for the hell of it. After all, they hated his guts and had nothing to lose. He could see only two options: kill all of them before they got on the ferry, or turn them into the authorities. His pistol, a 9mm Sig Sauer P226, was stored in a lockbox on a shelf in the master bedroom closet. Getting to it and catching them by surprise was going to be difficult, if not impossible. He hoped the vodka would make them sleepy, but it seemed to have just the opposite effect, perhaps because of the adrenaline load of impending suicide. The trio remained alert, active, even animated. They kept their own weapons close at hand. If he didn't manage to dispatch them all in one go, the survivors would certainly kill him and then execute the plan on schedule. Because he wasn't that good a shot and never fired a weapon in a combat situation, going for the gun wasn't his first choice. Calling the police was his only realistic option, but he couldn't do it from inside the house for fear of being caught. His best bet was to sneak out when they weren't looking. He had to put enough distance between himself and the Spetsnaz to complete the call, which meant using his car to get away. He could tell the police it was a home invasion by strangers. There was no paper or electronic trail linking him to the rogue Spetsnaz or the submarine grounding. He could skate with U.S. authorities on the bioweapon plot, but skating with his own people was a different story. He had no idea who was behind the operation, and he had already been betrayed once by someone in the Russian establishment. He had to figure there would be retribution for giving up the conspirators. He was going to have to disappear from his handler's radar. It was an eventuality he was prepared for, with false documents, offshore bank accounts, and valid airline tickets.
How about some more food? I'm still hungry.
Me too. Not pizza, though.
It was Slaney's opportunity.
I've got some guacamole in the freezer in the garage. I can defrost it in the microwave.
Alone in the garage, Sid slowly opened the garage door, unlocked his Acura, and opened the door.
Shit.
Where do you think you're going?
As Slaney turned, his gaze dropped to the GSH-18 semi-auto pistol in Luria's right fist. The fat silencer tube was screwed on, and the hand that held the gun was rock steady.
You don't need me anymore. I've fulfilled my part of the mission. I've done my duty.
We need you to stay until the job is complete. Until after we deploy Red Frost, you might give us away.
I would never do that.
We can't take the risk. Too many brave men have already died for the sake of this mission.
I'm on your side. We're all on the same side.
Luria shook his head, then gestured with the handgun.
Pull down the door.
Slaney considered making a break for it, but there was no cover down the driveway. No way to avoid a bullet in the back of the neck. No one would see him die, either. The neighbor's view of his property was screened by fir trees. With his last hope slipping away, Slaney did as he was ordered. They started back to the kitchen, but Luria stopped him in front of the big freezer chest.
Open it. Empty it.
Don't do this. Please. You don't have to go through with it. You can still stop it. We can stop it together. We can take down the others if they don't agree. Afterward, you can vanish. I have plenty of money hidden away. I can supply you with false documents. You can disappear into Mexico or Guatemala and live like a king. No one will ever find you. The people of Seattle don't deserve to die. They're innocent.
No one is innocent.
You don't believe that. You couldn't believe that.
Luria put a hand in the middle of his back and pushed his upper body over the edge of the freezer. Frigid air burned the inside of his nostrils.
What about the little kids? What are they guilty of?
As Dr. Vorostov watched, Druspenskaya Sokolova drew 10 cc's of pharmaceutical-grade morphine into a large hypodermic syringe. Other than the two of them, the yawning, littered banquet room was deserted. It was empty of weapons and ammunition as well. The other conspirators were taking up positions in the catacombs for the final battle. Sokolova flicked the syringe's plastic body with a fingertip, then cleared the air bubble with the plunger, squirting a fine stream of fluid into the air. Snatching a cotton ball from her injection kit, she met his gaze. Words were unnecessary under the circumstances. Arching one black-penciled eyebrow, with a faintly amused gleam in her eyes, the former GRU officer silently asked the question. If Vorostov sought an easy exit from his suffering, Sokolova was more than willing to do the honors. But he didn't want to give her that power, or the pleasure she would take in exercising it. He didn't want to take any more morphine to ease his pain, either. Morphine fogged his brain and dulled his wits. Opposing forces were massing along the seacoast below. The pain would be over soon enough. Vorostov waved off the lethal overdose. The short woman shrugged as if it didn't matter to her one way or the other. She left the loaded syringe and a length of brown neoprene tubing among the debris on the table so he could inject himself if he changed his mind. Anticipating the close-quarters combat to come, Sokolova wore a sidearm. She carried a battered 9mm semi-automatic pistol in a high-riding ballistic nylon hip holster. Across her uniform jacket and wide chest hung an olive-drab shoulder bag, bulging with anti-personnel grenades.
See you in hell, old man. Looking forward to it, my dear.
The doctor couldn't imagine hell's agonies could hold a candle to what he endured on Earth. The woman marched out of the room in her oxblood Oxfords, leaving him to die alone. She hadn't offered to wheel him down into the catacombs. That would have meant a slow, difficult, multi-story stairway traverse. The abandonment to a certain death was no shock to Dr. Vorostov. It wasn't a big disappointment, either. He had no interest in extending what remained of his so-called life. The natural end to his suffering was going to be a long time in coming, and all the more unpleasant for it. Vorostov flicked his butane lighter and held the blue flame over a well-packed bowl of gummy black hashish. The pungent smoke burned deep into the center of his chest. Then, as the drug passed from lungs to bloodstream, from bloodstream to brain, wave after wave of chills coursed through his body. As the hash kicked in, his ambient level of pain faded a bit. The dull spear point twisting in his bowels and rectum became a mere splintery broom handle. The first volley of artillery shells slammed into the lower stories, rocking the floor beneath him and making his wheelchair hop in place. The power of the chain of explosions was astounding, humbling, like an angry god stomping, grinding, crushing the massive limestone blocks to powder, kicking out the cornerstones, collapsing the roof. Vorostov's wheelchair hopped about wildly as the floor turned from solid to liquid, a raging sea of buckling, swaying boards. He could feel the shockwaves of the detonations traveling through him, shaking his bones, slapping his innards against the inside of his body cavity. Great yawning cracks opened in the ceiling. Plaster and ancient dust rained down on his head. The air became chokingly, raspingly thick. The artillery barrage lasted for what seemed an eternity. Then, surely his countrymen hadn't run out of shells, he thought. The floor groaned, shifting, dropping farther, timbers cracking as stone gave way, tipping down toward the ruined balcony and hundreds of feet of freefall. Fate was beckoning to him, urging him to come out to play. Vorostov wasn't afraid of death. He made a career of studying it, perfecting it. He was curious, though. Would dying hurt more than he already hurt? Was that even possible? If it was, it was probably only fair. He killed thousands in the name of research and national defense, soon to be hundreds of thousands. Dr. Amiran Ivarostov wheeled himself over the rubble, through the boiling smoke, onto the sloping balcony. Avoiding the shell crater, he carefully rolled to the edge of the shrapnel-pocked limestone balustrade. It was checkout time. He was ready to receive the answer to the great question, what, if anything, comes after? From the direction of the sea, Vorostov thought he could hear the steady sound of approaching helicopter gunships. The smoke of the fire below gave the night sky a swirling, inky black quality. The shards of water he could see beyond the expanse of battle reflected dim starlight. The air was still. He stared so hard that he began to hallucinate. He saw flocks of immense black-winged angels rising out of the shadows of the treetops, and the muffled ringing in his ears turned to melancholy music, gypsy violins dripping ethno-sentimentality. Much farther away than he anticipated, lines of tracer fire streamed from low in the sky into hard sights along the access road. The Russian helicopters were only just starting to sweep up the slope. One of the helicopters materialized as it exploded. In a brilliant orange fireball, the aircraft tumbled to earth at the foot of the mountain and continued to burn. The gunship hovered off Vorostov's balcony, its rotor wash clearing away the smoke and dust. The Doctor of Death beheld his Angel of Death. Schwartz raced down the slope with the long gun slung over his right shoulder and all 25 pounds of it slapping hard against his back. Below him, smoke still boiled from the ruins of the cafe, but the heavier debris had fallen to earth. He didn't go back through the attic trap door because he anticipated being delayed by a confrontation with the irate homeowners. Seconds after the explosion, he pulled the sniper rifle's bipod free from the table, scrambled through the diamond-shaped window, and dropped onto the gently sloping roof of the front porch. From there, he swung down onto the shaky porch rail. As he sprinted, he replayed the horrendous blast in his mind's eye. All four walls blew out sideways, even as the roof blew upward, trademarks of high explosive and large quantity. He couldn't imagine how any of the hostages lived through it. He couldn't imagine how Paul could, either. Even as he was jumping out the attic window, Schwartz got orders from Stony Man to remain in the farmhouse. The cyber team figured there was a chance the explosion released Red Frost. Schwartz was the only member of Able Team far enough from the blast's epicenter to avoid exposure to the bacteria. Hell with that. Blancanellis was likely dead, Lyons and Grimaldi possibly infected by the bioweapon. No way could he stay in the farmhouse and twiddle his thumbs for hours waiting for the all clear or evacuation. At the bottom of the pasture, he jumped the wire fence and headed across the highway. To his right, about a quarter mile away, Grimaldi was setting down the helicopter. He was descending on the marshy flat on the waterside of Highway 101, roughly opposite the restaurant, now hidden from Schwartz's line of sight by treetops and the curve of the two-lane road. Detective DeWitt, her cheek covered with a wad of bloody gauze bandage, rose from behind the barrier of parked squad cars and moved to cut him off.
You can't go down there! We just got orders from your people to keep everyone back from the blast site, and the highway closed until the hazmat people from the state patrol show up!
Schwartz wanted to warn her about the possible bioweapon release and the mortal danger, but his hands were tied. That information was classified. She didn't have the proper clearance. Besides, if the detective was exposed, she was already dead. They were all already dead.
Were any of your guys at Ground Zero?
Yeah, one guy.
I hope he escaped.
That's what I need to find out.
Like I just said, you can't do that. Don't make me use force to restrain you!
DeWitt waved over a couple of sheriff's deputies who looked even more uncomfortable at the prospect than she did.
Sorry, ma'am, but I have different orders!
When he walked on, she said nothing and nobody tried to stop him. Maybe it was the expression on his face. Maybe it was the Barrett. As Schwartz reached the debris field, he saw Lyons and Grimaldi cross the road below on a dead run. Darting around the wrecked and abandoned vehicles, they vanished behind the mound of debris where large marges once stood. The cafe was an 8-foot-high, flattened donut of wood splinters, shredded pink fiberglass insulation, and shattered glass. The pall of smoke thinned down to a few scattered wisps. Schwartz broke into a trot. Mixed in with the wreckage, sticking to the crumpled sections of aluminum gutter, the ripped-off roofing material and the chunks of wallboard were tiny, wet shreds of pink flesh. Lyons and Grimaldi didn't look at all happy to see him, but they didn't look very surprised either.
You're not supposed to be here. You were supposed to stay uprange.
As if that was gonna happen.
What's done is done. If you're dosed, I'm dosed. We gotta find Rosario, and fast. He could be buried alive under there.
For crying out loud, where do we even start looking?
Last word we had, he was still in the crawl space under the floor. Blast went sideways and up, not so much down. For all we know, the foundation may still be intact below the rubble. Let's pull away some of this junk and find out.
It took the better part of 5 minutes for the three of them to clear the wreckage from a section of the foundation.
The foundation's still intact!
Schwartz squatted and peered through a screened vent. Because debris was blocking the vents on the far side, there wasn't much light coming through. He couldn't see all the way across the crawlspace.
Subfloor's partly caved in. Looks like the damage is directly under the center of the blast.
Where's Paul?
Rosario! Make some noise, goddammit! Let us know where you are!
Could he have survived under there? That was a hell of an explosion. Just the concussion.
The floor and subfloor would have given him some protection if he wasn't right under the blast.
Maybe he's not in there. Maybe he made it out. Maybe he made it into the creek bed behind the cafe before the explosion. If he did get out, that's where he would have gone, guaranteed. It's the nearest cover.
He could be lying in a creek bed. The concussion could have knocked him out. That's why he isn't answering. Or maybe he got hit by some of the flying crap.
Better check the creek first, on a double.
Schwartz led the way around what had once been the rear of the building. The picnic table vanished, so too the overflowing garbage bin. Lighter debris obscured the swath of tall grass. Exploded cardboard boxes of paper napkins, broken bags of flour, pots and pans, a buckled refrigerator door. The stand of alder saplings along the edge of the creek bank had been uprooted or snapped off at the base. When Schwartz looked over the edge, he saw the garbage bin on its side at the bottom. It had been blown clear of the building. Its smelly contents decorated the tree branches all along the opposite bank.
Let's split up. Check the far side of the creek, too, in case he managed to crawl out.
10 minutes of searching turned up nothing. They returned to the corner of Large Marge's foundation. Schwartz immediately wrenched the screen from the foundation vent.
I'm going in after him.
Be careful. The debris pile is anything but stable. You make one wrong move, and we're going to have to dig you out, too.
Rosario! Rosario! Damn it, make some noise if you're in there!
Son of a goddamn bitch! Fucking assholes fucking fucking buried me! When I get hold of them, I'll nail their sorry ass fucking asses!
Rosario Blancanales came to in the pitch dark at the bottom of Large Marge's sump pit, inside the derelict oil tank. He couldn't feel his limbs, and he couldn't make them move. Commands from brain to arms and legs somehow got scrambled or never arrived. He could think, but nothing else seemed to work. As the numbness persisted, he started to worry.
Am I paralyzed? Have I got some awful spinal injury? Then, am I dead?
Slowly, sensation returned to his body, and he knew he was still alive. The recovery of feeling was welcome, but not the least bit pleasant. His body ached all over, and it burned as if his skin was scalded down to the muscle. Under the circumstances, any sort of injury was possible. Broken bones, ruptured internal organs, concussion. The outside of the tank protected him from the crush force of the explosion's pressure wave, but the inner surface was pitted with rust, and the blast bounced him around inside it like a marble in a tin can. He couldn't remember the explosion, per se. He could remember trying to get out from under it. He could remember shouting a warning to Lyons and Grimaldi. He knew he banged his head because he tasted blood in his mouth, from a broken nose or a cut inside his mouth. It was impossible to tell. Blood was smeared all over his face. As he shifted his weight in the tank, there was no sound. All he could hear was a dull roar. It felt as if his head were stuffed with cotton. The white noise was so loud he couldn't hear his own heartbeat. When he was able to make a fist, Blancanales dragged himself out of the tank and flopped onto the concrete floor of the sump. It was very dark under the restaurant, much darker than before. He couldn't see his hand in front of his face.
Am I blind?
He fumbled for his mini flashlight, but it was gone. His wristwatch was still there. He flipped up the cover and was relieved to see the glowing hands and face. He had been unconscious for about 10 minutes. He didn't pause to check himself for injuries. All he wanted was out as fast as possible. He must find Lyons and Grimaldi. He knew they could be in much worse shape. When he pulled himself up to the top of the sump pit steps, he realized why it was so impenetrably dark. The joists and subfloor above were partially collapsed onto the rim of the pit. He found just enough space to squirm through. When he was through it, belly down on the cool dirt of the crawl space, he saw more fallen subfloor, dropped pipes and heating ducts, and on the other side of all that, a small, familiar rectangle of light. It looked very far away. Hand over hand, he dragged himself over the dirt and around the debris toward the foundation vent. He thought he was cursing. He could feel his lips moving. His vocal cords were vibrating, but he couldn't hear his own words. When he reached the inside of the foundation vent, he saw the screen was missing. Then a familiar face appeared in the gap in the cinder blocks. He thought he was saying or shouting, "Carl, you lucky bastard," but he couldn't tell if he was forming the words correctly or what volume he was producing. Lyons grabbed his outstretched hand and helped him out from under the restaurant and onto the grass. Lyons, Schwartz, and Grimaldi looked glad to see him. They actually high-fived. Then all of them were leaning over him, talking at once. He knew they were talking because their lips were moving. Blancanellis pointed his fingers at his ears and tried to holler at them, enunciating every word.
"Carl! You lucky bastard! Son of a bitch!"
When they got him spread out on the grass, Lyons' relief faded. Blancanellis looked bad. It was hard to tell where the dirt and rust ended and the gore began. There were big flakes of orange scale in his white hair and on his face. Then Blancanellis pointed at his ears.
"I can't hear a fucking thing!"
"Okay, okay."
Lyons made a two-handed calm-down gesture.
"He's lost his hearing?"
"Looks like. Damn, how did he survive that blast?"
Lyons repeated the calm-down hand gestures as he spoke, hoping that between them and lip-reading, Blancanellis would get the picture.
"Just stay still, Paul. We'll get the EMTs over here."
"I'm on it."
At Lyons' direction, he and Grimaldi carefully looked Blancanellis over for obvious serious wounds. They didn't want him to bleed to death before help arrived, and they couldn't move him around for fear of making things worse.
"I don't see any bleeders, but he could be badly busted up inside."
"Yeah, I know.
He could go into shock any second. We got nothing to wrap him up with."
"He's not shaking. It's a good sign. He seems to be alert. We gotta keep him that way. Keep him talking."
Lyons leaned over his old friend.
"What happened?"
Blancanellis nodded that he understood the question.
"Old oil tank. Steel tank in a concrete well. End of it was cut out. I crawled inside before it all blew. Who else made it out?"
"Just you."
When Blancanellis looked puzzled, Lyons pointed a finger at him and shook his head. With Schwartz in the lead, three EMTs showed up carrying a folded-up stretcher and their medical kits.
"Please, step back."
The head EMT was a small, wiry guy with a thick brown mustache.
"Give him room to work."
As Lyons and Grimaldi backed away, the EMTs knelt around Blancanellis. They immediately began taking his vital signs. The head guy checked his pupils for a possible brain injury. When one of the crew started cutting off his DHS uniform shirt with a pair of blunt-tipped scissors, Blancanellis reached out and stopped him. With an effort, he sat himself up.
"Just a goddamn minute."
He tried to push away the six latex-gloved hands that were trying to make him lie back down.
"Don't make us restrain you, sir. You have to lie still so we can examine you."
"He can't hear a word you're saying. The explosion messed up his ears."
"And you better watch out, because he can still kick your asses one-handed."
The EMTs drew back a bit and kept their hands to themselves.
"Is he going to lose his hearing permanently?"
"No way to tell at this point. Your friend needs to go to the hospital immediately. Nobody walks away from a blast like that without sustaining serious injury."
"I don't know. He looks pretty lively to me."
"He could have critical internal injuries, and his combativeness could be the result of brain trauma. We have no way of telling until he starts to go downhill, and by then it might be too late to reverse things. You've got a helicopter sitting over there on the marsh. We'll stabilize him for transport. You can fly him to Harbor View, land on their helipad. We'll radio ahead that you're coming. There'll be an ER team on standby, waiting for your arrival."
Lyons frowned. He knew Blancanellis could be dying. Hell, they could all be dying if Red Frost released in the blast. In point of fact, he didn't have a choice in the matter.
"Nobody's leaving until we get the all clear."
I don't understand. What's all clear?
You don't have to understand anything. It's Homeland Security procedure. That's all you need to know. Take him back to the EMT truck. Work on him there. Make him as comfortable as you can until we can airlift him out. He gave Blancanales the thumbs-up sign. Blancanales nodded and returned the gesture. As they carried him off in the stretcher, Lyons contacted Stony Man via the secure link.
Paul survived. He found a hidey hole in a sump pit under the restaurant. So, we survived the blast. Now we wait to see if it released red frost. In another hour or so, we'll know if we were exposed. In the meantime, we're not going to just sit on our hands. We're going to start sifting through the wreckage and see what we can dig out. Maybe recover something from the bodies of the dead Spetsnaz. You don't have a live video feed of the aftermath, but it's a real mess. The building was reduced to a pile of splinters by C4.
Wait a minute. You sure it was C4?
Yep, it had to be. All signs point to it.
HE is not a good way to disperse this particular bioweapon. In fact, it's a real bad way. The extreme temperatures produced at the point of the explosion would destroy most of the encysted bacteria before spreading it. High heat is about the only thing that can reliably kill this puppy.
That's a positive, then. There's a good chance that either the hostage takers didn't have any red frost with them, or if they did, it was destroyed in the blast.
Everyone was trying to look on the bright side, trying very hard.
Keep us posted on the developments.
Roger that.
The ABLE team leader stared at the flattened mass of debris. It looked like a giant pile of toothpicks, or the middle of a landfill. He figured 15 pounds of C4 was needed to do that much structural damage. The shockwave produced by the high explosive would have killed everyone inside instantly, literally blowing them apart.
What are we looking for?
Where do we even start? There's not going to be anything left of the backpack or the bioweapon or the guy who detonated the C4. That blast turned him into red mist.
We're looking for what's left of the other guy, the one Gadget shot from the farmhouse. He was down on the far side of the counter when the C4 went off. He would have been partially shielded. His body could have been thrown clear. It's a long shot, but there might be something in his clothes, something we can use to figure out how many of these bastards are left and what their next move is.
We're on the wrong side of the building, then.
Gadget is right. The blast would have tossed him the other way, toward the highway.
They rounded the blast perimeter, walking on the edge of the strewn rubbish to the far side.
What we need is some heavy equipment to shift the wreckage. Doing it by hand is going to be slower than slow.
Even if we had bulldozers to help us, it could take a couple of days to sift through all this crap. We don't have that kind of time. And we can't wait until the feds get around to sending in a crime scene unit. We have to do it ourselves.
How long have we been at this?
Well, Jack, about 45 minutes or so.
Got clothing here. Bodies, too.
Lyons and Grimaldi hurried over to help him pull off the debris. They uncovered several badly mangled corpses at the foot of the front wall, one in black battle trim.
That's our guy.
The dead Spetsnaz looked as if he had been hit by a tank or dropped from a great height. Inside his skin, everything was crushed, every bone broken, his organs liquefied. They identified him by the vampire tattoo on his forearm and the all-black clothing. He was missing an arm, too, but that didn't distinguish him from the other victims. When they turned him face up, they could see the force of the explosion drove jagged pieces of wood from the service counter through his torso. The bloody spike ends stuck out through what was left of his t-shirt. A thorough check turned up nothing in his pockets or shoes. He carried no ID. All the labels were torn out of his clothing. Grimaldi stood up.
Yeah, shit. We got zip.
Maybe if we searched again, maybe we could find something we missed.
Lyons didn't respond. Even if they sifted everything through a fine mesh screen, it was needle in a haystack time. Grimaldi looked over his shoulder at the carnage their search revealed and shook his head.
We couldn't save any of them. There was nothing we could do. Whoever called them on that cell phone gave them the pull-the-plug signal. At that point, it was out of our hands. I gotta check in with Stony Man. Hal, we got nothing. Everything looks like it was run through a wood chipper. Maybe there's something here somewhere. Maybe if we had a month and 20 trained technicians helping us, we could reconstruct what body part goes to what person and what shred of paper might belong to that person. What I'm saying is, without a complete crime scene reconstruction, whatever we find, we can't tie directly to the dead Spetsnaz.
So we still got no way to pin down the real target, if there is one. No way to tell how many bad guys are involved, or how much red frost they've got.
They're still Phoenix. They may come up with something on their end.
How are you feeling?
We're all fine. No stiff joints, no breathing or speech problems.
Well, if you were infected, you should have started feeling the symptoms by now. Joint pain, fever, disorientation?
None of that. We're fine.
That's great news.
What about Rosario? How's he doing?
According to the last word we've got from the EMTs, he's stable. His vitals are all good, but his hearing is still impaired. Could take days for it to come back.
That makes him a liability on the mission. As long as he's not in danger, get him ambulanced to a hospital.
He's not going to be happy about being left out.
Happy has nothing to do with it.
I'd hand him the phone so you could tell him that yourself, but he can't hear anything.
That's what's known as a silver lining.
David McCarter waved his men through the open arched doorway and into the ground floor. The building's upper stories were either cleared of hostiles or on fire, thanks to the artillery and rocket barrages. Though the barrage stopped, it was anything but quiet on the hillside cliff. The blaze in the far wing crackled and popped. There were loud crashes from above as ceilings, walls, and floors caved in on themselves.
Now this'll be interesting.
When McCarter entered the wide foyer after Hawkins, he noticed wisps of smoke hanging around the ceiling. It was noticeably warmer inside, and not from the central heating. That gave the Briton pause. Once again, he got the distinct feeling Spetsnaz had no master plan. They didn't have everything under control. He didn't like the idea of taking his men deep below ground with a fire raging in the structure standing over them, a fire that might block their only way out. McCarter could see similar concern, if not doubt, written on Manning's tanned, weathered face. The Canadian looked at him and smiled grimly.
Yeah, interesting.
They met no opposition thus far. The badge Spetsnaz were either beaten back or retreated to the catacombs. Following Ilitch and his crew, who seemed to know where they were going, they trotted through wide, deserted rooms and narrow hallways with towering ceilings. What furniture there was shattered. The floor underfoot was covered with grit from fallen ceiling plaster and littered with spent cartridge casings. Bullet and Gren shrapnel holes marked the walls, doors, and moldings. There were dead guys, too. Dead bad guys in woodland camouflage. Their bodies were dragged out of the way and thrown into the nearest corners, leaving shoulder-wide blood smears on the scarred wood parquet. Moving in the massive Spetsnaz, McCarter, Manning, James, Enciso, and Hawkins passed through a double doorway and entered a great hall with a two-story ceiling. Inside were many more troops. They were assembled at the far corner. They wore their biohazard suits, but they held their protective hoods in their hands. Major Avragarov stood with them, also in the body part of his hazard suit. He was wearing a black throat microphone and earpiece. Some of the other troopers were likewise wired, presumably the officers and non-coms. A crude decontamination unit stood along the left side of the room. It consisted of a row of portable showers and hoses connecting them to opaque plastic barrels of bluish liquid. There were no live prisoners McCarter could see. The conspirators were fighting to the bitter end. Not that they had any choice. Based on the Spetsnaz approach, surrender served no purpose except to facilitate death. Some of the Spetsnaz were aiming their AKS assault rifles through a doorless archway. As McCarter got closer, he realized they were guarding the entrance to the stairs leading down. It appeared no one on Avragarov's side had yet descended into the monastery's catacombs. The major waited for the full complement of troops to arrive before he initiated the assault.
Put your biohazard suits on now.
Ilyich turned to the men of Phoenix Force.
Leave the night sights behind. They can't be used with the suits because of the faceplate. There are high-intensity headlamps built into the helmets.
McCarter and the others took their suits from the bags and slipped them on. They had double lapels with double zippers and built-in boots and gauntlets. They stank of uncured plastic, like cheap inflatable air mattresses, and they were very hot. On the upside, the legs and shoulders were baggy enough to provide a full range of movement. Phoenix Force waited with the others for the order to put on their head protection. At Ilyich's direction, his men passed out small air tanks and showed Phoenix Force how to connect them to the suit's built-in nipple.
How much air time do we have in these tanks?
Half an hour per tank. We will be carrying some spares with us. Check your watches when you turn them on. You will have to keep track of the time yourselves.
At a signal from the Major, everyone in the hall donned their hoods and prepared for the attack, turning on the canned air supply. When Avragarov signaled again, four of his troopers armed and chucked a clutch of high-explosive anti-personnel grenades, known as HEAPs, through the doorway opening, down the hidden staircase. The men guarding the entrance moved well back, but kept their weapons leveled.
The floor shook. After the last one went off, Avrogarov gave the signal to advance. With Captain Ilyich in the lead, the Spetsnaz rushed through the doorway double file through the rising smoke of the grenade detonations. Phoenix Force fell in line behind the first contingent. There were at least 30 soldiers ahead of McCarter, including the Major. Some of the Spetsnaz carried flamethrower tanks strapped to their backs. Most carried AKS-74s. The stairwell was circular and made of yellowish limestone. The rock was dished out, polished by centuries of boot soles. Through the haze of smoke left by the grenades, torches still burned greasily in the iron wall stanchions. McCarter automatically started counting the steps. It was a reflexive gesture. In the plastic helmet, it was hard to see his feet. Counting made him concentrate. At about step 45, he saw the first scorch marks from the grenades. The blasts put out torches. At step 64, he had to jump over a dead bad guy, his chest torn open from collarbone to belly by hot shrapnel, his shredded uniform still smoking. The Briton lost count around step 120. It was a hell of a long way down. He had no doubt Avrogarov would have gassed his opponents underground like moles or rats if it were a viable option. The opposition in this case probably carried its own breathing gear, which could negate the effects of a poison gas attack. And the penetration and saturation of any sort of gas was dependent on the volume introduced, the size of the target area, and temperature variations within it. In the light of dozens of bouncing headlamps, McCarter could see the plastic-suited men below him disappearing two at a time through a hole in the wall. The stairs ended in a stone archway. The entrance to the catacombs had no door. It also had no guard. On the heels of the Spetsnaz, McCarter entered a rough-hewed, curving passage about 7 feet wide. Its irregular walls polished and lubricated by the passing of countless human hands, thousands upon thousands of outstretched, sweaty palms over centuries, feeling their way to safety, to a cure. The ceiling was angled upward, like the peak of a tent, and blackened by torch soot. It varied in height, making him think that great blocks of stone had fallen away. Clearly, these caves weren't man-made. They were hollowed out by water percolating down from above. There was water standing in puddles on the gritty limestone floor. Here and there, it seeped through the walls in tiny beads like sweat or tears. Shallow side rooms stood carved out on either side of the corridor. They looked ancient, probably cut by hand chisels. McCarter glimpsed sleeping benches, niches for holy statues, places for penitents to rest and to pray. Even through the biosuit, he could feel the pervasive dampness. Ahead of him, men were occasionally peeling off from the file. They were disappearing into side passages, even narrower seams in the rock running perpendicular to the main corridor. Some of them were barely wide enough for a person to slide through sideways. They were moving quickly, though. By the time McCarter passed the entrances, the glow of their headlamps was already gone. Evidently, Avrogarov's plan was to clear the entire maze chamber by chamber, crossroad by crossroad. From the crude map McCarter saw, he knew the central hub of the spider web of natural and man-made passages was the shrine of the Holy Spring. That was where the conspirators would keep Red Frost. That's where they would release it, too, in the heart of the catacombs. McCarter glanced back to check on his men.
Everybody's there.
The Phoenix Force warrior barely had time to put his arm out before the floor flew up and hit him. Bits of metal sang over his head. The explosion did more than bowl over the Spetsnaz in front of him. It tore them apart. The middle of the file was gone in an instant, in a brilliant flash and roiling cloud of smoke and dust. Those in front of the blast, including Avrogarov and Ilyich, were cut off from the rest.
Anti-personnel mine on a floor rigged with a remote detonator for a time delay. I meant to cut off the head and divide the force. Well, it worked.
Men in camouflage burst from a cross passage on the other side of the explosion, jumping into the main corridor with guns blazing. McCarter returned fire through the boiling dust, staying low and bracing himself by pressing his shoulder against the wall. Manning did the same from the other side of the passage. James and Cizo and Hawkins had to duck for cover behind them. In the narrow tunnel, without a clear firing lane, they couldn't shoot back. McCarter aimed just above the flashes and pinned the AKS trigger. He put half a dozen shots into an imaginary circle the size of a dinner plate. One of the dark shapes slumped to the floor. The Briton followed up, the trigger still pinned, taking out a second man. Through the smoke, two more were blown off their feet, either by Manning's gun or good guys firing from the other side of the breach. Then, as suddenly as they appeared, the crouching figures were gone, vanished back into the rockwork like a pack of cockroaches. McCarter and Manning stood up.
You okay?
Never better, but you're kind of a mess, aren't you? Hawkins, how are you?
For the first time, McCarter noticed something sprayed over his visor. Gobs of red, like bits of raw hamburger. It was gore from the blown-up Spetsnaz. He bent down, scooped up some water from a puddle, and rinsed it off.
These suits are total bullshit.
Maybe so, but to keep us from being mistaken for the enemy and getting shot in the back.
On the far side of the crater, in the floor, a soldier in a biohazard suit appeared through the smoke and waved them on. The troopers, behind Phoenix Force, started forward again. McCarter and the others advanced, stepping around and over the bodies of the fallen of both sides. They were about 20 yards down the corridor when from the rear came a few scattered single gunshots. They all turned to look. The Spetsnaz were firing into the bodies point blank, flash hiders to temples, making sure their enemies were extra dead.